I Believe by Tuesday Lobsang Rampa, read for you by Blue Friend in beautiful BC. Chapter 1. Miss Matilda Hucklesnickler of Upper Little Puddle Patch sat at her half-opened window. The book she was reading attracted her whole attention. A funeral cortege went by without her shadow falling across the fine lace curtains adorning her windows. An altercation between two neighbors went unremarked by a movement of the apodaspera framing the center of the lower window. Miss Matilda was reading. Putting down the book upon her lap for a moment, she raised her steel-rimmed spectacles to her forehead while she rubbed at her red-rimmed eyes. Then, putting her spectacles back in place upon her rather prominent nose, she picked up the book and read some more. In a cage, a green and yellow parrot, beady-eyed, looked down with some curiosity. And then there was a raucous squawk. "Polly wants out! Polly wants out!" Miss Matilda Hucklesnickler jumped to her feet with a start. "Oh, good gracious me!" she exclaimed. "I'm so sorry, my poor little darling. I quite forgot to transfer you to your perch." Carefully she opened the door of the gilt wire cage, and, putting a hand inside, she lifted the somewhat tattered old parrot and gently drew him through the opened cage door. "Polly want out! Polly want out!" squawked the parrot again. "Oh, you stupid bird," replied Miss Matilda, "you are out. I'm going to put you on your perch." So saying, she put the parrot on the crossbar of a 5-foot pole, which at its distal end resulted in a tray or catch pan. Carefully she put a little chain around the parrot's left leg, and then made sure that the water bowl and the seed bowl at one end of the support were full. The parrot ruffled his feathers and then put its head beneath one wing, making cooing, chirping noises as it did so. "Ah, Polly," said Miss Matilda, "you should come and read this book with me. It's all about the things we are when we are not here. I wish I knew what the author really believed," she said, as she sat down again and, very carefully and modestly, arranged her skirts so that not even her knees were showing. She picked up the book again, and then hesitated halfway between lap and reading position, hesitated and put the book down while she reached for a long knitting needle. And then, with a vigor surprising in such an elderly lady, she gave a whole delightful scratch all along her spine between the shoulder blades. "Oh," she exclaimed, "what a wonderful relief that is! I'm sure there's something wrong with my liberty bodice. I think I must have got a rough hair there or something. Oh, let me scratch again. It's such a relief." With that, she agitated the knitting needle vigorously, her face beaming with pleasure as she did so. With that item behind her, and her itch settled for the moment, she replaced the knitting needle and picked up the book. "Deaf," she said to herself, or possibly to the unheeding parrot, "if I only knew what this author really believes about after death." She stopped for a moment and reached to the other side of the apodaspera bowl so that she could pick up some soft candies she had put there. Then, with a sigh, she got to her feet again and passed one to the parrot, which was eyeing her very fiercely. The bird took it with a snap and held it in its beak. Miss Matilda, with the knitting needle now in one hand again, and a candy in her mouth and a book in her left hand, settled herself again and continued her reading. A few lines on, she stopped again. Why is it that the father always says that if one is not a good Catholic, a good church-attending Catholic, one is not able to attain to the kingdom of heaven? I wonder if the father is wrong and if people of other religions go to heaven as well. She lapsed into silence again, except for the faint mumbling that she made as she tried to visualize some of the more unfamiliar words: Akashic record, astral travel, the heavenly fields. The sun moved across the top of the house, and Miss Matilda sat and read. The parrot, with head beneath a wing, slept on. Only an infrequent twitch betrayed any sign of life. Then a church clock chimed away in the distance, and Miss Matilda came to life with a jerk. "Oh, my goodness me, oh, my goodness me," she exclaimed. "I've forgotten all about tea, and I have to go to the church women's meeting." She jumped rapidly to her feet and very carefully put an embroidered pin into the paperback book, which she then hid beneath a sewing table. She moved away to prepare her belated tea, and as she did so, only the parrot would have heard her murmur, "Oh, I do wish I knew what this author really believed. I do wish I could have a talk with him. It would be such a comfort." On a far-off sunny island, which shall be nameless, although indeed it could be named, for this is true, a gentleman of color stretched languorously beneath the ample shade of an old, old tree. Lazily he put down the book he was reading and reached up for a luscious fruit, which was dangling enticingly nearby. With an idle movement, he plucked the fruit, inspected it to see that it was free of insects, and then popped it into his capacious mouth. "Gee," he mumbled over the obstruction of the fruit, "gee, I sure don't know what this cat's getting at. I sure do wish I knew what he really believed." He stretched again and eased his back into a more comfortable position against the bole of the tree. Idly he swatted at a passing fly. Missing, he let his hand continue the motion, and it idly picked up his book again. "Life after death, astral travel, the Akashic record." The gentleman of color riffled through some pages. He wanted to get to the end of the stuff without the necessity of all the work involved in reading it, word by word. He read a paragraph here and a sentence there, and then idly turned to another page. "Gee," he repeated, "I wish I knew what he believed." But the sun was hot, the hum of the insects soporific. Gradually, the gentleman of color's head sank upon his chest. Slowly, his dark fingers relaxed, and the paperback book slithered from his nerveless hands and slid down to the gentle sand. The gentleman of color snored and snored, and was oblivious to all that went on about him in the mundane sphere of activity. A passing youth glanced at the sleeping Negro and looked down at the book. Glancing again at the sleeper, the youth edged forward and with prehensile toes reached and picked up the book, which, with bent leg, he quickly transferred to his hand. Holding the book on the side away from the sleeper, he moved away, looking too innocent to be true. Anyway, he went into the little copse of trees. Passing through, he came again into the sunlight and to a stretch of dazzling white sand. The boom of the breakers sounded in his ears, but went unnoticed because this was his life. The sound of the waves on the rock around the lagoon was an everyday sound to him. The hum of the insects and the chittering of the cicadas were his life, and as such went unnoticed. On he went, scuffling the fine sand with his toes, for there was always hope that some treasure or some coin would be unearthed, for hadn't a friend of his once picked up a golden piece of 8 while doing this? There was a narrow strip of water dividing him from a spit of land containing 3 solitary trees. Wading, he soon traversed the interruption and made his way to the space between the 3 trees. Carefully, he lay down and slowly excavated a little pit to hold his hip bones. Then he rested his head comfortably against the tree root and looked at the book which he had filched from the sleeper. Carefully he looked around to make sure he was not observed, to make sure no one was chasing him. Satisfied that all was safe, he settled back again and rubbed one hand through his woolly hair, while with the other he idly turned over the book, first to the back, where he read what the publisher had to say, and then he flipped the book over and studied the picture through half-closed slitted eyes and with furrowed brows and puckered lips as he muttered things incomprehensible to himself. He scratched his crotch and pulled his pants to a more comfortable position. Then, resting on his left elbow, he flipped open the pages and started to read. Thought forms? Mantras? Man, oh man, ain't that sure something. So maybe I could make a thought form and then Abigail would have to do whatever I wanted her to do. Gee, man, yeah, I sure could go for that. He rolled back and picked at his nose for a bit, and then he said, I wonder if I can believe all this. The shadowed recesses of the room exuded an atmosphere of sanctity. All was quiet, except that in the deep stone fireplace logs burned and sputtered. Every so often a jet of steam would shoot out and hiss angrily at the flames. Steam generated by moisture trapped within imperfectly dried logs. Every so often the wood would erupt in a little explosion, sending a shower of sparks upwards. The flickering light added a strange feeling to the room, a feeling of mystery. At one side of the fireplace, a deep, deep armchair stood with its back facing the door. An old-fashioned stand lamp, made of brass rods, stood beside the chair, and soft light was emitted from the medium-powered electric light bulb concealed within the recesses of a green shade. The light went down and then disappeared from sight because of the obstruction of the back of the chair. There came a dry cough and the rustling of turning pages. Again, There was silence, except for the sputtering of a fire and for the regular fingering of paper as red pages were turned to reveal new material. From the far distance, there came the tolling of a bell, a tolling of slow tempo, and then, soon, there followed the shuffling of sandal-shod feet and the very soft murmur of voices. There was a clang of an opening door, and a minute later, a hollow thud as the door was shut. Soon there came sounds of an organ, and male voices raised in song. The song went on for some time, and then there was rustling, followed by silence, and the silence was destroyed by mumbling voices, murmuring something incomprehensible, but very well rehearsed. In the room, there was a startling slap of a book as it fell to the floor, and then a dark figure jumped up. Oh, my goodness me, I must have fallen asleep. What a perfectly astonishing thing to do. The dark-robed figure bent to pick up the book and carefully opened it to the appropriate page. Meticulously, he inserted a bookmark and quite respectfully placed the book on the table beside him. For some moments he sat there with hands clasped and furrowed brow, and then he lifted from the chair, dropped to his knees, facing a crucifix on the wall. Kneeling, hands clasped, head bowed, he muttered a prayer of supplication for guidance. That completed, he rose to his feet and went to the fireplace and placed another log on the brightly glowing embers. For some time, he sat crouched at the side of the stone fireplace, with head cupped between his hands. On a sudden impulse, he slapped his thigh and jumped to his feet. Rapidly, he crossed the dark room and moved to a desk, concealed in the shadows. A quick movement, a pull at the cord, and that corner of the room was flooded with warm light. The figure drew back a chair and opened the lid of the desk and then sat down. For a moment, he sat gazing blankly at the sheet of paper he had just put before him. Absently, he put out his right hand to feel for the book that wasn't there, and with a muttered exclamation of annoyance, he rose to his feet, went to the chair to pick up the book deposited on the chair-side table. Back at the desk, he sat and rifled through the pages until he found that which he sought, an address. Quickly, he addressed an envelope and then sat and pondered, sorting out his thoughts, wondering what to do, wondering how to phrase the words that he wanted to use. Soon he put nib to paper, and all was quiet except for the scratching of a nib and the ticking of a distant clock. "Dear Dr. Rampa," the letter commenced, "I am a Jesuit priest. I'm a lecturer in the humanities at our college, and I've read your books with more than the normal interest. I believe that only those who follow our own form of religion are able to obtain salvation through the blood of our Lord Jesus Christ. I believe that when I'm teaching my students. I believe that when I am within the church itself. But when I'm alone, in the dark hours of the night, when there is none to watch my reactions or analyze my thoughts, then I wonder, am I right in my belief? Is there no one except a Catholic who may be saved? What of other religions Are they all false? Are they all works of the devil? Or have I and others of my belief been misled? Your books have shed so much light and enabled me greatly, and I would ask you, sir, will you answer me some questions so that you may either shed some new light or strengthen that in which I believe? Carefully he appended his name. Carefully he folded the letter and was inserting it in the envelope when a thought occurred to him. Quickly, almost guiltily, he snatched out the letter, unfolded it, and added a postscript. I ask of you, Your Honor, as one devoted to your own belief, not to mention my name, nor that I have written to you, as it is contrary to the rules of my order. He initialed it, dried the ink, and then quickly reinserted the folded letter in the envelope and sealed it. He fumbled among his papers until he found a book, and in that he made a note of the postage to Canada. Searching in drawers and pigeonholes eventually produced the appropriate stamps, which were affixed to the envelope. The priest then carefully tucked the letter in the inner recesses of his gown. Rising to his feet, he extinguished the light and left the room. "Ah, Father," said a voice out in the corridor, "are you going into town, or can I do anything for you there? I have to go on an errand, and I should be happy to be of service to you." "No, thank you, brother," replied the senior professor to his subordinate. "I have a mind to take a turn in the town and to get some much-needed exercise, so I think I will just stroll down to the main street." Gravely they took half a bow to each other, and each went his own separate way. The senior professor went out of the age-old building of gray stone, stained with age and half-covered with climbing ivy. Slowly he walked along the main drive, hands clasped about his crucifix, mumbling to himself, as was the wont of those of his order. In the main street, just beyond the great gate, people bowed respectfully at his appearance, and many crossed themselves. Slowly, the elderly professor walked down the street to the letter box outside the post office. Guiltily, surreptitiously, he looked about him to see if any of his order were nearby. Satisfied that all was secure, he removed the letter from his robes and flicked it into the letter box. Then, with a heartfelt sigh of relief, he turned and retraced his steps. Back in his private study, again by the side of the sparkling fire, and with the well-shaded light casting illumination on his book, he read and read deep into the hours of the night. At last he closed the book, locked it away, and went off to his cell, murmuring to himself, "What should I believe? What should I believe?" The lowering sky gazed dourly upon nighttime London. The teeming rain swept down upon the shivering streets, scurrying passers-by with grimly held umbrellas braced against the wind. London, the lights of London, and people hurrying home from work. Buses roared by, great giant red buses, scattering water all over the sidewalks, and shivering groups of people trying to avoid the dirty spray. In shop fronts, people huddled in groups waiting for their own buses to come along, dashing out eagerly as a bus came along, and then slinking back despondently as the indicators showed the wrong numbers. London, with half the city going home and the other half coming on duty. In Harley Street, the heart of London's medical world, a gray-haired man paced restlessly on a bearskin rug in front of a roaring fire. Back and forth he strode, hands clasped behind his back, head bowed upon his chest. Then, on impulse, he flung himself into a well-padded leather armchair and pulled a book out of his pocket. Quickly, he flipped through the pages until he found the passage he needed, a passage about the human aura. He read it again, and having read it, turned back and read it once again. For a time he sat gazing into the fire, and then he nodded in resolution and jumped to his feet. Quickly he left the room and went into another. Carefully he locked the door behind him and went to his desk. Pushing aside a lot of medical reports and certificates yet to be signed, he sat down, took out some private notepaper from a drawer. "Dear Dr. Rampa," he wrote in an almost undecipherable handwriting, "I have read your book with absolute fascination, a fascination heightened very greatly by my own belief, by my own knowledge, that what you write is true." He sat back and carefully read what he had just written, and to be quite sure he read it once again before resuming. "I have a son, a bright young fellow who recently had an operation to his brain. Now, since that operation, he tells us that he's able to see strange colors around human bodies. He's able to see lights about the human head. But not only the human head, not only the human body, but around animals as well. For some time we have thought deeply on this matter, wondering what it was that we did wrong in the operation, thinking, perhaps, that we had disorganized his optic nerve. But after reading your book, we know better. My son can see the human aura. Therefore, I know that what you write is the truth. I should very much like to meet you if you're in London, because I think you may be able to be of enormous assistance to my son. Yours very sincerely." He reread what he had written and then, like a priest before him, was about to fold the letter and insert it in the envelope, but his eyes fell upon the bust of a medical pioneer. The specialist started as if he had been stung by a bee and quickly grabbed his pen again and added a postscript to his letter. "I trust that you will not reveal my name or the contents of this letter to anyone, because it would injure my status in the eyes of my colleagues." Carefully, he initialed it, folded it, and put it in its envelope. Carefully, he extinguished the lights and left the room. Outside, his very expensive car was waiting. The chauffeur jumped to attention as the specialist said, "To the post office in Leicester Square. The car drove off, and soon the letter was dropped into the letterbox and eventually reached its destination. And so the letters came in. Letters from here, letters from there, letters from everywhere. From the north to the south and from east to west, letters, letters, letters. An unending shoal of letters, all demanding an answer, all asserting that their own problems were unique, and no one ever before had such problems. Letters of condemnation, letters of praise, letters of supplication. From Trinidad came a letter written on the cheapest form of school exercise paper in an absolutely illiterate handwriting. I am a holy missionary. I am working for the good of God. Give me $10,000 and a new station wagon. Oh yes, and while you're about it, send me a free set of your books, and then I shall believe what you write. From Singapore came a letter from two young Chinese men. We want to be doctors. We have no money. We want you to pay our first-class airfare from Singapore to your home, and then we'll talk to you and tell you how you can give us the money so that we may be trained as doctors and do good for mankind. And you might send us some extra money so we can see a friend of ours in New York. Do that for us, and you'll be doing good for people. And then we will believe. The letters came in their hundreds, in the thousands, all demanding an answer. Few, a pitiful few, even thought of the expense of writing, of stationery, of postage. They wrote, "Tell us more about what happens after death. Tell us more, what is death? We don't understand about dying. You don't tell us enough. You don't make it clear. Tell us everything." Others wrote, "Tell us about religions. Tell us if we have hope after this life when we're not Catholics." Yet others wrote, "Give me a mantra so that I can win the Irish sweepstake. And if I win the first prize of $1 million in the Irish sweepstake, I'll give you 10%. And yet another person wrote, "I live in New Mexico. There's a lost mine here. Tell me where the lost mine is. You can go into the astral and find it. And if you tell me where it is, and I find it and make it mine, I'll give you a present of some money for your services." People wrote that I should tell them more, tell them all, tell them more than all, so that they would know what to believe. Mrs. Sheila Rouse sat grimly at her desk. Her gold-rimmed glasses were perched precariously on the bridge of her nose, and every so often she would put a finger up and push them back into place. She looked at the wheelchair passing her door and said, somewhat fiercely, "You've only written 16 books. Why not write another, the 17th, telling people what they can believe? Look at all these letters you've had asking for another book, asking you to tell them what they can believe. I'll type it for you," she concluded brightly. Miss Tadalinka and Miss Cleopatra Rampa sat in the corridor of the front of the wheelchair and smiled contentedly. Miss Taddy deep in thought, had to scratch her left ear with her left foot while she concentrated on the implications of yet another book. Satisfied, she rose to her legs and waddled away back to her favorite chair. Mama San Rab Rampa looked up with a rather pale, bemused expression on her face. Without a word, perhaps she was speechless, she handed me a piece of blue card with the heading of Mama San Rab Rampa Pussy Willow. And then in the center of the page, I saw my own face in blue, just as if I'd been dead for too long and dug up too late. And below that, the weirdest looking Siamese cat face I've ever seen. Well, for a time it left me speechless, but I suppose that it is nice to see the first cover of one's first book. I'm biased because this is my 17th, and there is no longer any novelty. But, Mama-san, I said, what do you think of another book? Is it worth all the effort, with me stuck in bed like a stupid dummy, or shall I give it up? Mama-san metaphorically uncrossed her eyes after the impact of her first book cover and said, oh yes, of course you should write a book. I'm thinking of writing my second. Miss Cleo and Miss Taddy took a good sniff at the cover and walked away with their tails in the air. Apparently it met with their approval. Just then, the telephone rang, and it was John Henderson, away in the wilds of the USA, at the confluence of many waters. He said, hi, boss. I've been reading some very good articles in praise of you. There's a good one in the magazine I've sent on to you. Well, John, I replied, I couldn't care two hoots, or even one hoot, what magazines or newspapers write about me. I do not read them, whether they're good or bad articles. But what do you think of another book, a 17th? Gee, boss, said John Henderson, that's what I've been waiting to hear. It's time you wrote another book. Everyone is anxious, and I understand the booksellers are getting many inquiries. Well, that was quite a blow. Everyone seemed to be ganging up. Everyone seemed to want another book. But what can a poor fellow do when he is approaching the end of his life and he has a ferocious tax demand from a wholly unsympathetic country? And something has to be done to keep the home fires burning, or to keep the income tax jackals from the front door. One of the things I feel better about, the income tax, I'm very disabled. Most of my time is spent in bed. I am not a charge on the country, but I pay a most vicious tax without any allowances because I'm an author working at home. And yet, some of the oil companies here do not pay any tax at all because some of them are engaged upon entirely mythical research, and as such they're tax exempt. And then I think of some of these crackpot cultists who set up a non-profit organization paying themselves, their relatives, and their friends high salaries, but they pay no tax because they are registered as a non-profit organization. So it came about that, unwillingly, it was necessary for me to write a 17th book. And so the consensus of opinion was, after a perusal of letter after letter after letter, that the title should be, I Believe. This book will tell of life before birth, life on earth, and the passing from earth, and return to life beyond. I have the title of I Believe, but that is wholly incorrect. It's not a question of belief. It is knowledge. I can do everything that I write about. I can go into the astral as easily as another person can go into another room. Well, that's what I cannot do. Go into another room without fiddling about on crutches and a wheelchair and all the rest of it. But in the astral, one doesn't need crutches, wheelchairs, or drugs. So what I write about in this book is the truth. I'm not expressing an opinion, but just telling things as they really are. Now's the time to get down to it. So, on to chapter 2. End of chapter 1.